There's so much going on in the third Aliyah of Parshas Vayetze that we'll just have to choose some highlights to speak about. In the very beginning of the Aliyah, we find that Yaakov agrees to work for 7 years in order to marry Rachel because he loves her so much. And that's actually a halachic problem, because we have a rule that when it comes to a poel who commits his time rather than one who is agreeing to do a specific job, so there are limitations as to how far you can go to committing your time, because we're worried about the prohibition of ki li bnei Yisrael avadim v'lo avadim la'avadim, that we are servants to God, not servants to human beings. And if we commit ourselves out for too long of a time or too absolutely, it's a little too close to slavery. So the view of the Mordechai, this quote of the halacha, is that to commit yourself for more than 3 years as a poel is a halachic problem. And here we find Yaakov committing himself to 7 years. So this is discussed in the Paris Yosef and elsewhere. And there are those who suggest that maybe it's mutter for extenuating circumstances, such as to get married. It's permissible, for example, if one has no other way to make a parnasa. So perhaps this is derived from there. This was something that was above and beyond. And therefore, even though it's not normally permitted, Yaakov felt it was necessary in order to be able to marry Rachel. And his desire to marry Rachel was so intense that the Pasuk tells us a phrase that seems a little bit hard to understand, that even though he's committing to 7 years, that v'yu beinav kiyamim achadim, that it was like just a few days. So one might think the opposite, that if you're very anxious for something and you have to wait a long time, normally it would feel like it's longer than it actually is. So the Chizkuni suggests that it means to convey to us just that it seemed like a bargain, because he recognized that this was such a tremendous opportunity to only have to pay 7 years of time for it. That seemed like a bargain, but not to suggest that it flew by quickly. It actually did feel like a very long time. He alternatively suggests that maybe afterwards it felt like it went by fast, but during the time of waiting, it did indeed feel like a very hard time, but a very long time. But Rav Moshe Sternbuch has an alternative explanation, which is a very fascinating perspective, that Yaakov appreciated that this was a tremendous spiritual opportunity for him to be able to marry Rachel. And if that's the case, then that requires preparation in order to be able to maximize that spiritual opportunity. So therefore, he cherished all the time that he had to prepare, realized it may not be enough, maybe he needs every moment. So therefore, 7 years, maybe that's not enough time in order to prepare for such a spiritual opportunity. It seemed like perhaps it was too short of a time for what could come of this. So this time passes, and then it ends up that he's actually married to Leah. So he expresses his amazement at this, and the Medrash tells us that Leah actually tells Yaakov that this was payback to you. I did to you what you did to your father. That you fooled your father and pretended to be Esav and took the brachos, so I did the same thing to you. And that may seem surprising to us, because we understand, we assume that Yaakov did what was necessary, he did the right thing, so the idea that there should be some kind of punishment, some kind of consequence, perhaps seems surprising. Rav Rivlin, the Mashkiach of Karen Biavna, discusses how you see from here that even an Avera that's Lishma, concept that we find in the Gemara, something that would normally be a prohibition, but is done for good reasons and can be justifiable, still there are consequences because of the Avera part, even if it's considered to be Lishma. And here we find an example of such a consequence. The Netziv, in his commentary Herchav Davar, suggests that there needed to be a consequence for an added aspect, because the Torah tells us, in Parshas Toldos, when Esav discovers what happened, so he cries bitterly. And Yaakov should have felt bad about that. He should have had sympathy for what Esav was feeling. And therefore, for that lack of sympathy, that's why he has to pay a price. So when Lavan is confronted with this, so Lavan says, well, this is what's appropriate, because for the younger child to get married before the older child, that's not appropriate. Lo yayase chein b'mkomeinu. That's not how we do things here. So it's an interesting and important question whether he's just reflecting his own attitude or whether this is a halachic value as well, that the younger child should not get married before the older child. There is a Tosfos in Maseches Kiddushin and Daf Nun Beis Amud Aleph where it sounds like this is somewhat of a halachic concept that it's recognized. As far as whether this is accepted at all by Poskim, so in the Tshuvos Avnei Chepetz, the Reish Rav, Rav Aaron Levine, So he assumes that actually this is something that is accepted lahalacha, that the younger child should not get married before the older child, and that they're not doing anything wrong by waiting because they're considered honest. It's considered to be something that they don't have a choice about. However, Moshe Feinstein, in his tshuvas, so he thought very much differently, that there is no prohibition at all on the younger child getting married before the older child. This is actually a topic that is extensively discussed among poskim. There's quite a lot written about this. The Klausenberger Rebbe has a tshuva about this, discussing many different angles. The tshuva shol and the darshan. There's a lot written about this, discussing many different perspectives about it. But it's also suggested, the Paris Yosef discusses, that it could be that he's trying to make a different point here by invoking the minig, that there's also a discussion in halacha that sometimes if there's a prevalent local minig, then that could cancel a tanai that's made. So maybe he's trying to argue that even if I made a deal with you, but if there's a minig a different way, so then I should have the right to invoke that minig, to cancel out the condition, and maybe that was his argument. There is an additional spin on this that focuses on an unusual pronunciation, on a Yiddish pronunciation. It's a story that's told that the Shabin Rav, Rav Dov Barry Schwedenfeld, once wanted to suggest a shidduch to a young man, and he was telling him at length about how wonderful she is, and he asked to see a picture of her. And the Shabiner Rabbitson overheard the story, and she said to him, Lo yayasa chen bimkomenu, that's not what we do here. La seis hatzi'ira lifnei habichira. So the Yiddish pronunciation of the words, we don't do that here, that we should give the tzira, we should give a picture, lifnei habichira, before the girl. You should meet the girl first, you shouldn't have to ask to see a picture beforehand, which is a very interesting representation of this phrase, and has a lot to say about perhaps some current trends. So it's a question about this particular phrase, one way or another, however you pronounce it, whether this is contemporary Jewish practice. But the next pasuk does represent Jewish contemporary halacha, although it's a question whether this is the source or not, because the next pasuk tells us that Lavan says, Male Shavua Zos, that okay, if you want to marry Rachel also, so you have to work another 7 years, but you don't wait another 7 years. How long does he have to wait? He has to wait a week. So why does he have to wait a week? So that's because there is a halacha of Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha. Now, we don't want to mix two simchas, so you have to have the Shavuot Brachos first for Leah, and then after the Shavuot Brachos is finished, so then you can marry Rachel and have the Shavuot Brachos for her. And the Talmud Yerushalmi, and Moed Katan understands from here that there is this din of Ema Arvin Simcha B'Simcha. That's not where the Talmud Bavli learns it from. The Talmud Bavli learns it from the Pasuk B'Samachta B'Chagacha, B'Chagacha V'lo B'Ishtacha. But this is where the Yerushalmi learns it from. The Tar Tamima notes that this is actually a bigger chumrah than what we're familiar with. So it's usually not so practical for us that we're considering marrying two wives in the same week. But what theoretically could have been relevant is the question of getting married on Chol HaMoed. So we assume that that's an Isser D'Oraisa because of the drasha on the Pasuk, the Samachta V'Chagecha. So we can't have a marriage take place on Chol HaMoed. So that's how we understand, derived from that Pasuk. But as the Torah Tamima notes, it's actually a bigger chumrah here because there we're only concerned about the wedding itself overlapping with Yontif. So if one were to get married before Yontif and the Sheva Brachos were to go into Yontif and go into Chol HaMoed, that would be okay. So how come here you see a bigger chumrah that we're not just worried that you shouldn't have the two weddings on the same day? He's saying that you have to allow the entire period of the Sheva Brachos for the first sister to finish, and then only after that week is over, then you can have the Sheva Brachos and the wedding for the second sister. So the Torah Tamima suggests that it's a different kind of clash when it comes to a wedding and Yontif on the one hand, and two weddings on the other hand. And when it comes to two weddings, you have to worry about personal emotions, you have to worry about jealousy, and that's a more intense kind of clash. So then you need the entire Sheva Brachos to finish. When it comes to Yontif, it's not that there's a jealousy involved, it's just the dilution of one simcha from the other. So to keep them apart only to the extent that you have the wedding itself before Yantif, that's okay, even if it ends up that the Shavu Brachos period is going to extend into Yantif. It is interesting that this halacha, at least according to the Yerushalmi, will be learnt from Lavan. So the Osnayim LaTorah suggests that it's not really that we learn it from Lavan, that Lavan was actually just saying this because he knew it was something that Yaakov would care about. So it's perhaps an existing value that Lavan was reflecting back to Yaakov. But it sounds like from the Yerushalmi that this is learnt from Lavan. Could even be that the previous point is also something learned from Lavan for those who felt that that's also a value that was accepted. So there is a interesting mahalach about this that was said both by the Torah Tamima in his Sefer Baruch Shamar on his commentary on the Siddur, where he talks about Matovu and the fact that we cite that from Bilam, and also the author of the Pardes Yosef in his introduction, where he talks about the fact that there is somewhat of a stira, somewhat of a contradiction, perhaps, that the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos tells us that Ezehu Chacham, what does it mean to be a Chacham? Somebody who is Lomed Mikol Adam, somebody who's able to learn from everyone. But the Gemara elsewhere says, Ezehu Chacham Haroes HaNolad, a person who is a Chacham, somebody who's Roas HaNolad, we often translate as someone who's able to anticipate what is yet to come. So it sounds like it's a contradiction. What kind of a standard is there to be a Chacham? Two different things are offered as a definition of a Chacham. So maybe it may not be the kind of question that keeps you up at night. You could probably have two different ways to define a Chacham. But they both suggest that actually they really mean the same thing. That Haroes HaNolad should be translated differently, not necessarily somebody who anticipates what's yet to come. But it means that you don't necessarily look so much at the molid when you're trying to figure out whether a piece of wisdom should be accepted or not. So you don't focus on the person who's creating the idea, the molid, but rather your roes hanolad. You look at the idea itself. So rather, if you interpret it that way, it's really saying the same thing as the Mishnah in Avos, Halo made me kol adam, that you're willing to take chachma from wherever it comes. So if the idea is worthy, so then it doesn't matter who says it. So we're willing to take the Chachma. So the Pardes Yosef writes in his Akdamas, even if you don't like me, you should like my Sefer, because you should be Roas HaNolad rather than the Molad. And the Baruch Shamar says that's also why we're able to quote Bilam and say Matovu Halacha, because we look at the idea itself. And that perhaps we could also quote Lavan, that if Lavan says something that makes sense, so then we should accept that Lahalacha. So he ends up indeed marrying both Rachel and Leah. And of course, this is the question that many try to figure out: how could it be that Yaakov is able to marry two sisters, if we know that the Avos kept the entire Torah before it was given, so there's a prohibition against marrying two sisters? So how could Yaakov violate this prohibition? So there are many answers that are given. The Ramban thought that this was only observed in Eretz Yisrael, so maybe that could be one explanation. You could also perhaps suggest that the idea that the Avos kept the entire Torah, that was done specifically not as a commandment. The Torah wasn't given yet. So the notion of the Avos keeping the Torah is because they intuited, as the Rashba explains in his Tshuvas, and as others explain, they figured out what the values of the Torah were, and they decided to observe them even before they were actually commanded. So for us, who have the Torah as a commandment, so we say, Ein Dorshin Taima Dekra, that we don't have the right to decide what a mitzvah means, and to assume that its rules follow whatever interpretation we give it. But if we are not commanded to follow the Torah itself, we're only intuiting the principles of the Torah, so then perhaps there shouldn't be a problem of Ein Dorshin Taima Dekra. The Avos didn't have a tzivoy. They were only observing the rules based on the Taima Dekra, based on the reasoning of what would ultimately be the Kra. So they should have the right to be Doresh Taima of the ultimate Kra, to act based on what they think the reasoning is. So it could be that when it comes to the prohibition of marrying two sisters, they understood, or Yaakov understood here, that the issue is you can't marry two sisters because they're going to be fighting all the time, and there's going to be jealousy. So that's true in general. But here he sees that there's such cooperation between Rachel and Leah, and that Rachel gave Leah the simanim in order to be able to pass herself off as Rachel. So such a bond of love between the two, perhaps there wasn't going to be fighting between the two of them, and therefore he had the right to assume that the prohibition of marrying two sisters, which he was only observing voluntarily without a tzivui, so he has the right to assume that the logic of it doesn't apply in this case, and therefore he shouldn't have to take it on voluntarily. And perhaps that's a one way of understanding why he would have been able to go ahead with marrying two sisters in this case. So he does indeed marry both of them. And the Torah goes on to say that it was a difficult situation for Leah, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw ki snua Leah, that Leah was snua, which would sound like it means that she's hated. So that's a difficult interpretation, because hard to believe that Yaakov would hate Leah. Chazal read it a little bit differently. A couple of suggestions how to understand it. There are those who suggest, hearing a lecture once from Professor Tzvi Zubin, that the word snua in the Torah doesn't always mean hated. Often it means, it's a comparative term, it means less loved. So she was less preferred to Rachel. Rav Schwab, in a similar vein, understands that when you're talking about a wife, anyone who is loved less is by definition considered hated, because to love a wife any less than absolutely is itself a problem. So therefore, because he loved Rachel more, so therefore this language fits in the direction of Leah. So that's another way to understand it. The Torah now goes on to tell us about the birth of the first few sons of Yaakov, and tells us about the birth of Reuven. So when Reuven is born, the Torah describes that she said about Reuven, Leah said about Reuven, Ki amra, ki ra Hashem ba'anyi, ki ata yehavani ishi. So Hashem saw my suffering, so she calls him Reuven. And the Gemara Maseches Brachos tells a totally different reason why she called him Reuven, that she said that Reu ma ben bini leben chami, that you should see what's the difference between my son and the son of my father-in-law, that my son Reuven is going to lose his status to Yosef, and he'll be okay with it, while the son of my father-in-law, Esav, he loses his status to Yaakov, and he's very upset about it. So why is there a contradiction between what Chazal say she had in mind and what the Torah says she had in mind? So I heard once an interesting interpretation from Rav Yisrael Reisman, who was discussing a halachic question. So sometimes there's pressure in a family to name a child after a certain family member, and for whatever reason, the parents are uncomfortable marrying after that family member. Perhaps they don't feel he's such a worthy choice. So the advice is given that they should pick somebody else with that same name and have that other person's name in mind when they name the child. So the response to that advice was, well, does that work? Does that work to say that, okay, you're having this person as the person you're naming after, when really you're thinking there's a different explanation? So he pointed to this Gemara and its explanation of Reuven's name. So here the Torah gives us one explanation of Reuven's name, and the Gemara tells us this other story that she had in mind to compare Reuven and his reaction to Esav and his reaction. So why is there this discrepancy? So he explained that perhaps she really had in mind this whole comparison between Reuven and Esav, but that's not what she's going to say at the bris. She's not going to say publicly this whole contrast. So in public, she said one thing, and in her mind, she had something else that was a little bit more complicated and not something she could really share. And apparently, that's still valid. Apparently, there is still such an idea, and that was something that, in theory, could work. So just to mention one closing idea here. So when Yehuda is born, so Leah's reaction is, here it's a fourth son. She says, Hapam Oda Es Hashem, now I will thank Hashem. And the Gemara says in Maseches Brachos and Dav Zayin and Bebeis that Miyom Shabara Karish Baruch Hu Esolamo Lahaya Adam Shahoda La Karish Baruch Hu Ad Shaba Leah Vahodaso. There wasn't anyone who ever thanked HaKadosh Baruch Hu until Leah came and thanked him. So that's very striking. Is this really the case? that this is the first time anyone thanked the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Certainly doesn't seem like it's the case. So one common interpretation, like the Torah Tumim and others have, is that Hodah means one who really recognizes that what they have is more than they deserve, is not what they think is coming to them. So she thought, Al Pi Ruach HaKodesh, that with four wives and 12 Shvatim, she was only going to have three sons. So when she had the fourth, so she recognized this was above and beyond. She had a real sense of Hodah, and that's what it means to really feel grateful, to really recognize that this is more than you think is coming to you. There's an additional interpretation, the Paris Yosef quotes from the Sefer Tiv Gittin of Rabbi Bish Harif, that Hodah means that when you think something was bad and it turns out good, so then that's when you really feel Hodah. So here, this all started that the Torah described that she felt less loved, however we translate Tznua, she felt that she wasn't the more preferred wife, and in conjunction with that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave her children, and now she has four sons. So this situation that was a negative situation, but it turned out to be a source of bracha, so that's where you really find Hodah, and that recognition that very often that which we think is bad for us and that which we think is a terrible matzav is able to turn out into something for which we are profoundly grateful. That's something to keep in mind and a source of ongoing hope for all of us.